Good evening, everybody, and welcome to What Clinicians Want to Know, addressing current questions and controversies in the management of acute myeloid leukemia. I'm Dr. Eitan Stein from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and I will be moderating the meeting today. This is our faculty for today, Dr. Alexander Sasha Pearl from the University of Pennsylvania, Dr. Richard Stone from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Dr. Eunice Wang from Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, and from way down under, Dr. Andrew Wei from the Peter MacCallum Cancer Center and Royal Melbourne Hospital. Here are the relevant faculty conflicts of interest that were up before. We'll just flip through these quickly. And here's our commercial support for today. The Research to Practice CME Planning Committee staff and reviewers did not have conflicts of interest to disclose. This program will contain discussion of non-approved uses of agents and regimens. Please refer to official prescribing information for each product for approved indications. So again, this is our program today. But really, in order to make this meeting more relevant to participants, we did a survey of 50 general medical oncologists, and the questions that were provided during that survey will be asked to the faculty at the end of each faculty lecture. The full survey results are on the iPads and Zoom chat room for your viewing. This is where we're headed today. Module one, Dr. Wei will be talking about the treatment for older patients with acute myeloid leukemia. Module two, Dr. Stone will talk about selecting initial therapy for younger patients with AML without a targetable mutation, including those with secondary AML. Module three will be the role of FLT3 inhibitors in AML management by Dr. Pearl. I'll do module four, where we'll be talking about incorporation of IDH inhibitors into the care of patients with AML. And finally, module five will be done by Dr. Wang. She'll be talking about the potential role of menin inhibitors and other novel agents in the treatment of acute myeloid leukemia. Before we start, here's some data that was taken from that survey of general medical oncologists. In orange, what you can see is the first choice topic of interest for future CME programs, and in green is the second choice. You can see that the top first choice answer was the available efficacy and safety data with menin inhibitors, and the second choice was the treatment for older patients with newly diagnosed acute myeloid leukemia. And with that, I'm going to pass it over to Dr. Wei, who's going to tell us about the treatment for older patients with AML. Dr. Wei, take it away.
Thanks very much, Eitan, and hello, everyone. So about two-thirds of patients who are diagnosed with AML are above the age of 60, and so management decisions regarding this older population is one of the most frequent challenges faced by treating clinicians. So in terms of making the decision between intensive or non-intensive chemotherapy, there are three major domains which physicians and patients need to consider. First of all, the physician is really trying to work out whether the patient is functionally fit to receive intensive chemotherapy. From the patient's point of view, their major concerns are what are the liabilities of having intensive chemotherapy in terms of time spent in hospital, quality of life impact, and also complications from treatment. It's fair to say that prior to the introduction of novel therapies, the appetite for risk was much higher because clinical response rates with intensive chemotherapy were substantially higher than available treatment options before the introduction of venetoclax and ivosidenib. And so factors such as survival and remission had to be counterbalanced with the appetite for risk. However, with the treatment landscape really evolving quite rapidly over the last few years, you can see that the introduction of ivosidenib, which was approved in 2022, and the full approval of venetoclax in 2020, really gave treatment options which produce response rates which are very similar to response rates achieved with intensive chemotherapy combinations in younger patients. And so the distinction between clinical outcomes in terms of response alone became a much lesser factor. And I think with this, the appetite for risk really has reduced in the clinical domain. And so the utilization of non-intensive therapies is now available, but now is very complicated because of a number of factors. The first factor is we now need to do rapid molecular screening in order to identify patients who might be suitable for targeted therapy. Second, there is an evolution in terms of risk stratification for these low-intensity therapies because of recognition that previous risk classification schemas do not apply adequately to this population. Third, there are more patients suitable for allogeneic transplant than were ever suitable in the pre-novel therapy era. And fourth, there are new frontiers in terms of MRD monitoring and potentially adapting therapy according to MRD-guided evidence. With respect to targeting IDH in the frontline setting, we know from Stefan de Baton and colleagues that the updated data from the AGILE trial shows that now with almost 29 months of median follow-up, that the survival improvement is very much sustained into the long term, with an almost threefold increase in the complete response rate compared to azacitidine alone, and median survival of over 29 months. For jurisdictions where ivosidenib is not available, azacitidine plus venetoclax for IDH1 mutant patients still represents a very effective and useful alternative strategy. You can see here that this is intensive chemotherapy results according to ELN 2022 risk stratification criteria for patients over the age of 60, and also ELN 22 risk stratification for patients who receive Venclexta. Two observations from these two graphs are firstly that patients with intermediate and adverse risk are poorly stratified by ELN 22 criteria for both intensive and non-intensive therapies. And secondly, you can see that for non-intensive therapies, there doesn't appear to be a subgroup for which there is a huge disadvantage to using non-intensive therapy compared to intensive therapy. And I think this is partly why Venclexta has become so prevalently used in the clinical domain. So in terms of trying to identify a more relevant risk stratification model for patients receiving Venclexta, A reanalysis of different molecular factors was undertaken, and this identified four factors illustrating the very poor outcomes of patients with P53 mutation. The intermediate outcomes for patients with FLT3-ITD or RAS variants, and the relatively better outcomes for patients lacking any of these four molecular abnormalities. And so in recognition of the need for a more tailored approach for risk stratifying patients who are elderly and receiving less intensive therapies, the ELN has recently published a new classification model, which is three-tiered, and really pointing out the very favourable outcomes of particularly mutated NPM1, which has a median survival of 39 months, and also IDH2, IDH1, and also DDX41, which also represents a new entity which has particular sensitivity to low-intensity therapies. Now, utilising Venclexta doesn't come without the requirement for the physician to be really aware of the risks and limitations of this therapy. So first of all, physicians need to be aware of the increased risk of febrile neutropenia and neutropenia, which requires active risk management and mitigation. Second, to be aware that dose intensity is quite important because increasing the intensity of Venclexta therapy doesn't necessarily improve efficacy, but certainly increases toxicity, particularly myelosuppression. And so we need to be aware of important practice points to minimize risk to hematopoietic progenitor integrity, particularly excessive doses, either numerically or pharmacokinetically with respect to venetoclax, and also allowing sufficient time for count recovery. And also deciding whether patients have a very good risk in which the clinical trial approach perhaps shouldn't be tinkered with versus patients with P53 mutation where perhaps dose intensity is less relevant and pulling back on the therapy may be more appropriate to reduce toxicity. Now, does this mean that intensive chemotherapy should be relegated to the halls of the therapeutic archives? Well, You can see here that this is a study done by Jan Beresdorf looking at patients who are elderly with NPM1 mutation, that is the subgroup potentially benefiting the most from Venclexta. And you can see that here, intensive chemotherapy is actually significantly better than HMA-Ven combinations. However, you can see in this non-randomized comparison that there are many confounding variables. 45% of patients in the Venclexta group were more than 75 years of age. There was almost threefold higher patients with respect to secondary AML, and you can see that transplantation was twice as frequent in the intensive group versus the non-intensive group. So we really do need to wait for randomized studies to be clear about this question. And another abstract which will be presented at ASH at this meeting, again, looking at the ELN favorable risk group with NPM1 mutation, age between 60 to 75 years, again showing an advantage to intensive chemotherapy versus Venclexta. Now, even the model of intensive chemotherapy in older patients is also going through evolution. So here is a study by the French group led by Christian Richer and colleagues looking at consolidation with conventional intermediate dose RFC versus mini-dose chemotherapy consolidation, showing that there is no difference in survival using the more intensive consolidation approach. Furthermore, this is the QUASAR study showing that oral azacitidine used in patients who achieved remission over the age of 55 without any consolidation produces a median survival of about 24 months compared to patients who receive oral azacitidine with consolidation therapy, where you can see the median survival is very much similar, really questioning how beneficial multiple cycles of intensive consolidation are in older patients with AML. And furthermore, you can see here this is a study called CAVIAT, which combines a reduced intensity chemotherapy approach, but this time with venetoclax incorporated into the frontline setting. Median age 71 years, median follow-up 3.5 years, and you can see the ELN favorable group has a median survival approaching 5 years, and less than 5% of this population were allografted. There is one group, however, which still remains a major problem, and that is P53 mutant disease. We now know that there are particularly patients with clonal hematopoiesis with P53. Not all of these patients get MDS or AML. We know that P53 mutant disease is very much a condition skewed towards elderly populations and increased by the presence of prior therapy or chemotherapy. And furthermore, that venetoclax does not appear to have a major benefit in this high-risk subgroup. There is another option for older patients with P53 where we're trying to focus more on quality of life because we can't improve clinical outcomes, and that is oral decitabine cedazuridine. You can see that compared to intravenous decitabine, oral decitabine has a longer half-life and has some accumulation between days 2 to 5. And furthermore, that in patients with AML, this recently published study, that the response rates are about 35% with oral decitabine. And you can see that patients with P53 mutation, although the median survival is less than 6 months, that there are almost 20% of people alive at 1 year and 13% at 2 years. And so for a population which is not necessarily curable, reducing toxicity and increasing convenience may be a reasonable alternative. And lastly, you can see here that there is an evolution of therapy in elderly AML, which is combining oral combinations such as decitabine with drugs like venetoclax, ivosidenib in triple combination, and also gilteritinib and menin inhibitors, again in triple combination, producing response rates which really do challenge the need for intravenous or subcutaneous therapy, and perhaps in the future more and more people will receive all oral therapy on an outpatient basis. So with that, I'd like to conclude that therapy for elderly AML has been transformed. There are new considerations with respect to the inclusion of targeted therapy, molecular risk stratification, and emerging novel combinations aimed at reducing toxicity. And I haven't had a chance to talk today about MRD-guided therapy. But just to point out, although elderly AML therapy is now, there's so many more options, it really does require the physician to really put skin in the game, tailor the patient's therapy to make it more personalised, and there is no longer a one-size-fits-all approach. And with that, I thank you for your attention.
Okay, that was wonderful, Andrews. You know, I thought we would start with just some simple questions. And a lot of the questions that we got from the general medical oncologists really revolve around how do we handle Ven/Aza? A great treatment, as you showed in those new ELN risk stratification, but it comes with some learning. So just a simple question to start. The first question was, you start HMA-Ven, when do you do that first bone marrow biopsy? I know some places do it early, some places do it late. What do you do?
First, I think, point to make is that with HMA alone, responses took 3 to 4 cycles. But with Aza and Ven, the responses 3/4 occur after the first cycle. So there is really a strong imperative to do that first bone marrow in the first cycle. I generally do it between days 21 to 28. If you're going to give a 28-day schedule, then it's relevant to do one at day 21 in order to stop the venetoclax. If you're not going to give more than 21 days, then I think doing a bone marrow at 28 just to check that the patient's in remission is adequate, because then you need to sit tight and wait for the counts to recover before the next cycle. Whereas if the patient's not in remission, then getting on with the second cycle of therapy, because it may take 2 or 3 cycles in a proportion of patients, is relevant.
Sasha, is it at 10? Are you guys doing the same thing?
Yeah, we're checking at about 21 days, mostly because, if you've cleared the marrow of the blasts, we don't think there's much benefit to giving extra venetoclax at that point. We really want to give some time to recovery. Lastly, you can give G-CSF in that setting, and that actually may accelerate recovery if patients are at risk for infections. That may, decrease that risk. I think from a safety standpoint, that's important. And often that will be the case on subsequent cycles, too.
Okay, great. Now, one of the third question that comes here is the dose and schedule of venetoclax needs modification almost all the time. You know, sometimes we see situations where you give a cycle of venetoclax or 2 cycles of venetoclax, the blasts are gone, or maybe there's a little bit of MRD, but the counts are not coming up. At what point do you give another cycle of venetoclax? Maybe Rich, maybe this one to you. Another cycle of venetoclax, or how long do you wait? What do you do when there's MRD there? All sorts of important questions.
Those are great questions. I tend to try to avoid more venetoclax if the blasts in the marrow are less than 5% and the counts are still low, because I think at that point the risk outweighs the benefit. I don't check MRD in the typical scenario. I just look at the blast count and decide what to do with the Aza-Ven. If they still have blasts and they're doing okay, I will administer the Aza-Ven on time, much like Sasha and Andrew just mentioned.
Okay. All right. And what about you, Eunice?
So I think I agree. I mean, I think that one of the major problems with continuing venetoclax obviously is the myelosuppression. So there's been a study from France, a retrospective study, or a study of several centers, where they actually gave 7 days of Ven with 7 days of HMA and saw similar response rates as doing a longer course, 14, 21, 28 days. So what I think that the lowest I would go would really be the 7 days of the venetoclax and the 7 days of the HMA. But I do agree that in the beginning, when you're looking for response, I typically do at least 21 days for the first cycle, and then I decrease from there. Like if they have a marrow that's empty or less than 5%, I drop to 14 days, and then I might drop to 7 days in subsequent cycles.
Yes, Sasha.
One thing, just to follow up on something Andrew said in his talk, is that patients with mutations in TP53 have not shown an improvement in survival with this regimen, but they do have a higher remission rate. So if I see that the patient is responding to venetoclax and azacitidine, and I didn't have a TP53 mutation on the day I met the patient, and I get that and find that they have responded, but they're having sluggish count recovery, I'm pretty quick to get rid of the venetoclax and just switch to HMA alone.
Have any of you adopted the so-called, as Eunice was talking about, the so-called 7+7 regimen to start 7 days of venetoclax with 7 days of azacitidine? Andrew, what are you guys doing in Australia?
I tend to look at the risk profile of the patient first. So as I mentioned before, if the patient has a very high likelihood of long-term remission like NPM1 or IDH2 mutation, we don't yet know whether reducing the Ven way down to 7 days is going to produce those results. So I try to keep the schedule at least 21 days. If, however, the patient has myelofibrosis, high risk of marrow suppression, delayed recovery, very elderly with many comorbidities, high risk of complications, or P53 mutation, then I'm very happy to reduce the Ven down to 7 days, because it's safety first with no guarantee of efficacy.
Okay. So I think we should get now to the maybe the underbelly of what of the talk, which is triplets. So what do we do? You know, there are now folks who are advocating, and there's data that reports that adding a targeted agent to patients with a FLT3 mutation or an IDH mutation may be a safe thing to do, and perhaps it's also very effective. In your practices, I'll start with Eunice, are you routinely, let's take a FLT3 mutated patient, do you routinely, let me just give you the case, FLT3 mutated patient, 79 years old, good performance status, not a transplant candidate for whatever reason. Do you give Azaven FLT3 inhibitor or Azaven?
So we actually just had like this patient the other day in my practice, and there was a lot of debate. I think that we obviously prefer to give it on a clinical trial. We don't know the optimal dosing of triplet therapy in terms of how long to give Ven, how long to give the FLT3 inhibitor, when to do the bone marrow. There is data from the MD Anderson group about doing, you know, 14 days of Ven, 14 days of GILT, 7 days of AZA. So if push came to shove and this patient was not a transplant candidate, a fit person, good performance status, we could consider off-label. However, in general, we still go forward with in most patients with the Ven and the AZA. I think the problem with giving the triplets is that you're worried about the myelosuppression with the two drugs. And when you go into the three-drug regimen, in the absence of clinical trial justification, you're a little bit like potentially putting the patient at risk for prolonged myelosuppression. So like as Andrew mentioned, you know, you really in some patients want to be focusing on safety of patients, certainly patients that have myelofibrosis, P53 disease, prior MDS, baseline cytopenias. I would be a little bit more hesitant about doing a triplet. In a specific case where we know the FLT3 inhibitor might be a benefit, patient's not going to study and they're not going to transplant, there may be a role.
Okay, Rich, what's going on in New England?
I essentially agree with what Eunice said. We don't routinely use the gilteritinib or any other FLT3 inhibitor for that matter, along with Azaven in non-transplant candidate, older adults, chiefly because we don't know if that prolongs overall survival. There is a myelosuppressive cost, and it might turn out to be equivalent to use the gilteritinib, if that's what you're going to use later, rather than mixing it with the Azaven. I'm hopeful that triplets will turn out to be better, but we just don't know yet.
Do you think, Andrew, that we need to wait for randomized phase 3 data to broadly adopt triplets off study?
In essence, to recommend it broadly, I think that is true. I mean, we all thought that azacitidine plus gilteritinib would be a laydown Mazaire success, but Eunice obviously showed us that's not the case. And so we can't assume that logic will always pan out in a randomized setting. But it is intriguing that the utilization of FLT3 inhibitor could be incorporated into Ven-Aza because of FLT3 being one of the major pathways to Ven-Aza escape in terms of resistance. At this year's ASH, one of our colleagues, Dr. Chul, will be presenting the results of a randomized phase 2 study looking at Aza, Ven, plus or minus midostaurin. Why midostaurin? It's a much more short half-life FLT3 inhibitor and hence overcomes the gilteritinib issues of 140-hour half-life targeting FLT3, which is one of the critical survival factors for intermediate normal myeloid cells. And we found that by using a sequential approach, that is starting the midostaurin after the chemotherapy, that there was nowhere near as much myelosuppression, no need to truncate the venetoclax, 67% chance of eradicating FLT3 MRD using highly sensitive NGS and able to deliver more than 12 cycles in a quarter of the patient. So it is possible to deliver triplets, but we do need randomized studies to inform practice.
Okay, and everyone be sure to look at that presentation or poster publication. I'm not sure which one it is.
Oral
session. Please go to that. Sounds like it's going to be interesting. One last question for the group. And this is something I think that comes up in all of our practices all the time. You've got a patient who has been on azacitidine and venetoclax for 3 years. They're in very, very good shape. They have an IDH1 mutation. And it's getting tough to treat them. You're treating them every 8 weeks because of the myelosuppression. You've reduced their venetoclax to 7 days because of the myelosuppression. At what point, maybe Sasha, do you think, can that patient ever be stopped from Azaven and just observed? Or should that patient be switched to single agent Aza? or a single agent ven or an IDH inhibitor, what should we do about that patient?
I think this is a great question. In my personal experience, the only patients I've stopped azaven and felt comfortable saying we have decent data to do this are patients in whom we not only perhaps have an IDH1 mutation, but have an NPM1 mutation. And that mutation is undetectable, where we can really track it at a low level. Because that's a mutation that's not associated with CHIP. That's a mutation that's associated with leukemia. And there's an experience, not a huge experience, but an experience saying that there are patients that we can identify in which therapy's been stopped when they were in an MRD negative state and they've been followed and they've had a longer remission off therapy than perhaps the therapy had been delivered. In all of those patients, they were treated for over a year though. And so you need to have that kind of an experience. So that's been my, you know, approach to this is just to say, we don't know the right answer here. My big worry when we stop therapy is if the disease starts growing again, will it respond the second time around? An advantage with an IDH mutant disease is perhaps a few, you know, different tools in the toolkit there that you can use. But in me personally, I'm a little loath to stop therapy outside of the setting of NPM1 mutant disease.
Would anyone consider like azaven induction for 6 cycles and then IDH inhibitor maintenance therapy as a single agent? Rich is saying no. New England, yeah. No.
I just don't know enough data to support that approach. I think we'd certainly want to investigate the NGS/MRD status after 6 cycles. And Sasha said, if it's NPM1, it's gone. Maybe after a year, you could stop. There's data supporting that. IDH, if the IDH clone was still present, I would consider it, I guess. But I don't have, without any known data to support it.
Okay, sounds like what we're hearing is we need data for a lot of things. And when we get that data, we should make big changes in practice. But until then, don't rock the boat too much and follow the data. Okay, so thanks so much to all of you. We're going to move on. And our next presentation is going to be from Dr. Stone, who's going to talk about selecting initial therapy for younger patients with AML without a targetable mutation, including those with secondary AML.
Dr. Stein, thank you very much. Esteemed colleagues, thank you all for coming. And thanks to Dr. Love and the incredible Research to Practice Enterprise for inviting us here today and me to talk about selection of initial therapy for patients with AML, including those with secondary AML, who don't have a targetable mutation. What is a targetable mutation? It's going to change, right? Today, I would submit that the only targeted mutations we really have are FLT3-ITD and FLT3-TKD. But soon, thanks to work done by my colleagues and others around the world, we might be saying NPM1 is targetable, maybe IDH1 and IDH2, as you'll hear from Eitan, and maybe even KIT next on the horizon. So for today, I'm going to spend half my talk discussing about 3 and 7. Is that really the backbone? Do we know the optimal daunorubicin dose? Should we add a nucleoside analog? Should we add gemtuzumab? Should we add venetoclax? Well, one of the more tedious debates in our field is the dose of daunorubicin during induction. So I'll get it out of the way right now. A study done years ago by ECOG suggested that 90 was better than 45. So if I get about 45 as the dose of daunorubicin, what about 90 versus 60? I think the predominance of the evidence suggests that 60 is the right dose. Nothing wrong with 90 probably in fit patients, but 60 was not inferior to 90 in the UK study, was not inferior to 90 in a recently published German study by Dr. Rohlig, who also showed, incidentally, that you don't need to give a second induction like they do in Europe if you're responding well to the first induction, which corresponds to the North American practice. Nucleoside analogs. There's a host of published regimens using nucleoside analogs in AML. There's cladribine and cytarabine. There's cladribine, cytarabine, and mitoxantrone. There's probably the most famous one is FLAG-IDA, which is fludarabine, cytarabine with G-CSF, and idarubicin. And there's that Polish study, now a classic, of comparing cladribine, daunorubicin, cytarabine to daunorubicin, cytarabine, which showed an improved leukemia-free survival and remission rate for those who were randomized to the triplet compared to the doublet. But it kind of got pushed by the wayside a little bit, I think because the control group who got the two drugs didn't quite perform as well as might have been expected. Folks in the UK have tried hard to look at the benefit of FLAG-IDA in induction in AML. They typically do very important but somewhat complicated trials. This trial basically explored 3 different induction regimens with or without gemtuzumab, one with etoposide, one just basically 3 and 7, although it wasn't 7, and then flag IDA with or without gemtuzumab. These curves on the bottom are those that show the ADE versus flag IDA comparison, irrespective of gemtuzumab. And what you can see here is that there's a trend toward a favorable overall survival with flag IDA, but a higher death and complete remission, which might have be the reason that it wasn't statistically significant. So flag IDA might be a very, with or without gemtuzumab, might be a very appropriate therapy for a very fit patient. Gemtuzumab, which I've been referring to, as you all know, is an anti-CD33 antibody conjugated to a calicheamycin toxin, which of course brings the toxin in apposition to the DNA, which causes DNA double-stranded breaks and blasts from patients with AML, 90% of whom express CD33. This is a now classic meta-analysis by Robert Hills of the UK, which suggested that those with favorable cytogenetics, which means inversion 16 and A21, benefited from the addition of gemtuzumab to chemotherapy, looking at 5 studies done on both sides of the Atlantic. Those who had adverse cytogenetic risk, again, this is before the ELN that incorporated genetics, adverse cytogenetics risk didn't benefit, and those with intermediate cytogenetic risk benefited significantly, but it was not absolutely a huge home run. I will say that you have to know exactly what type of patient you're treating when you choose therapy. This study was, if you just look at the top curve on the right, overall survival for CBF patients treated with daunorubicin, cytarabine, and 1 dose of gemtuzumab. I'm not going to get into the 1 versus 2 dose of gemtuzumab, but 97% 3-year overall survival. Pretty darn good, approaching what we get with APL. What about using gemtuzumab on top of chemotherapy with another type of what we now would consider favorable prognosis AML, that is NPM1 mutant? And this is a study published by Dr. Donner of the AMLSG in Germany, which showed that you could reduce the remission rate, reduce the relapse rate when you added gemtuzumab on top of idarubicin, aricin, etoposide, and retinoic acid, hardly a standard regimen, in America at least. So if you talk to Dr. Donner, he believes strongly in gemtuzumab in NPM1 patients. I wouldn't say that's a thought shared by everyone around the world. And now, venetoclax plus intensive chemo. It's not standard of care yet, but I think it's coming. We don't know yet. Dr. DiNardo, Dr. Lakowitz have published important data with fludarabine, cytarabine, GCSF, adarubicin, and venetoclax. I'll show you some of that. A Chinese group has published a very high CR rate, and most of those CRs are MRD negative, although there is a lot of sepsis with 3 and 7 plus venetoclax. Dr. Mansaris of Albert Einstein in the Bronx, New York, will be presenting a talk on 3 plus 7 plus venetoclax. You can come look at my poster, come say hello, on Monday evening, which shows a very high response rate with 3 plus 7 plus ven. You saw Dr. Wei's data with in older adults with 2 plus 5 plus ven, so maybe we can get away with that in younger adults. We certainly don't know that yet. Dr. Kadia of MD Anderson mixes up cladribine, idarubicin, cytarabine, and venetoclax, somewhat lower dose approach, and has got extremely good results. This is the regimen from Dr. DiNardo and Lakowitz, was published a couple of years ago, where they note they had to reduce the cytarabine dose and the venetoclax duration to get this in safely, but the response rate was very high. The MRD negative response rate among those who responded was very high, and if you take out the P53 patients who didn't do that well, no surprise, you have a good overall survival with reasonable follow-up. So the second question is, what is secondary AML? The clinical definition, as Andrew mentioned, after prior MDS or after prior cytotoxic chemotherapy. The definition in CPX351, of which I'll speak momentarily, which is liposomal daunorubicin cytarabine, is the same above plus those with MDS-related cytogenetics, whether or not they could have gotten prior HMA when they had MDS. A useful definition, and it's changing, is using the adverse risk ELN 2022 definition, because that takes advantage of the so-called Lindsley secondary mutations, where they have chromatin assembly or splices, RNA splicing mutations. So here's CPX351. Everybody knows what it looks like now. It's supposed to release the daunorubicin cytarabine in what's called a fixed molar ratio, which is supposed to be favorable for killing AML cells. Here was the trial that was published by Jeff Lancet, which looked at, as I said, therapy-related AML AML with history of MDS or CML or de novo AML with MDS karyotype, just between 60 and 75 years. Frankly, there was a little bit of data with CPX351 in younger adults, and I'll show it, but this is what I would say is older adults, 3 and 7 versus CPX351. It's a little bit more myelosuppressive to get the CPX351, maybe because it likes to hang out in the bone marrow microenvironment. It's not too much more toxic. In fact, in some ways, it's less toxic because it doesn't have the same degree of GI toxicity, but there was a significant amount of bacteremia in the CPX arm. So these are the long-term updated results, which show maintenance of the survival benefit for CPX compared to 3 and 7. More people got to transplant, and there weren't many. There were less deaths in the early period. If you got a transplant at any time in your course and you were exposed to CPX351, you did much better than if you had a transplant and were exposed to 3 and 7 earlier. Why is that? We don't really know, although I suspect it may have to do with a lower level of MRD, which should be the goal of all the stuff I'm talking about, to get to a low level of MRD. And if you need a transplant, you do very well when you go in there with MRD negativity. Now, not all patients benefit equally from CPX351. And this is old data, which is going to be updated by Dr. Shimoni tomorrow at an oral talk. He's in the back of the room. You can maybe get him to tell you what the answer today. But basically, CPX351 seems to be better than 3 and 7, particularly in those with so-called secondary mutations, the spliceosome and the chromatin ones, and not so hot if you have a signaling mutation, which is like RAS, FLT3, etc. This is the data I was referring to in the younger adults, or at least not terribly old adults, with CPX351 versus FLAG-IDA. And you can see in the middle that those with the secondary mutations in this study, published recently by Dr. Othman from the UK, sees that the ones who benefited from CPX351 were those with the secondary gene mutations. Is it more effective? Maybe a little bit, but I think what you look in the bottom right here, you'll see that there were fewer deaths in remission if you were exposed to CPX351. So maybe CPX351 compared to FLAG-IDA is just hits the right temperature at the right, the water's not too hot or too cold, and you have less deaths in remission, and that drives the survival benefit. Harkening back to something that Andrew talked about a few minutes ago, should we use Ven/Aza or CPX351 in people that have sort of adverse risk? And this is a retrospective study from Penn, I think. Is it? Yes.
Yep.
So, and you can see here, there's no difference between venetoclax and Aza versus CPX351. The whole issue is driven by whether or not you had a transplant. The ones who had transplant, no matter how they got there, did well. And finally, just a little bit of a teaser. Maybe Sasha will comment more about this in his talk, but maybe we'll be using a FLT3 inhibitor even in those who don't have FLT3 mutations. This is tantalizing data from Spain in the so-called Kiwi trial, which needs to get repeated in a worldwide trial, suggesting that quizartinib might have a role with 3 and 7, even in those patients who do not have an obvious FLT3 mutation by current technology. So this is a little algorithm that we put together, suggesting that we give intensive chemotherapy to most of the patients. We still sort of reserve obviously, FLT3 inhibitors for FLT3 mutant patients, and I don't really give, for people with double hit P53 mutations, I still use Aza-Ven or Aza alone. Hopefully, we'll answer some of these questions about the role of azacitidine and venetoclax and 3 and 7 and CPX in the various subgroups in the taxpayer-sponsored MyeloMatch trial, which is ongoing now. And we will have a trial for those with CBF, AML, 3 plus 7 plus GO versus 3 plus 7 plus VEN, trials in people with intermediate risk, and trials in people with high risk AML. So with that, I'll conclude, and I look forward to some of the questions that A10 will pose. Thank you.
Okay, I've always had respect for Dr. Love, but I have a new respect for Dr. Love standing up here and moderating and trying to get everything organized. So, Dr. Stone, I'm going to start with you, because this is something that I see all the time, even in institutions within a one-mile radius or 500-foot radius of my institution. And the question is, how do we choose between 7 and 3 and, let's say, FLAG-IDA or FLAG-IDA venetoclax, where there has certainly been creep of people starting to use FLAG-IDA venetoclax based on Courtney and Curtis's outstanding data? What do you do?
I still give 3 and 7 outside of a clinical trial to the vast majority of younger adults with AML. I don't think we've ever shown that anything is better than that, except maybe in the UK trial I showed FLAG-IDA might be a little bit better in a fit patient. I don't have any problem with it, but I still use 3 and 7 because I'm waiting for data to prove me wrong.
Are you waiting for a randomized phase 3 study of FLAG-IDA ven versus 7 and 3?
Yes.
Okay. Andrew?
So I guess one of the key questions at the moment is whether FLAG-IDA go is appropriate because of the study by the UK, AML18, showing superiority over DA-GO. One of the downsides of that study is, although it was randomized, there was no survival benefit overall, and most of the relapse-free survival benefit was driven by the FLT3 mutant patients, and in that study there was no FLT3 inhibitor given. And so, you know, Gail's robos came up to me and said, look, isn't FLAG-IDA go standard of care now? So, well, maybe not. So we're still using 7 and 3 until we have a properly conducted phase 3. With respect to when would I ever use FLAG-IDA ven up front in a young patient, I would use it in a patient where if the patient failed 7 and 3, I would give them FLAG-IDA ven next, because if they're a high risk of failing like a P53 mutant case, then I would probably do that. I would just do it first rather than try and do it on the salvage attempt. Why FLAG-IDA ven for P53? We don't have any strong evidence that it will work. In Courtney's paper, there were 10 patients with P53 mutation. Five out of 10 responded, and she got them to transplant. What happened after transplant? When I asked Courtney, she said most of them did relapse. So we don't have a great answer.
Okay, Sasha?
All I was going to say is I agree with you. I think we need randomized data. And I think one challenge of giving FLAG-IDA ven in the salvage setting is it's probably a good regimen in that setting, but I would not give it on a day 14 marrow when somebody's still aplastic from 7 and 3 and isn't fully recovered. That's just a recipe for a really long aplastic period. And there was a lot of sepsis in the early phase study, and that would worry me outside of a very carefully controlled trial that this can get into hot water very fast.
Eunice, are you adding ven to any of your upfront regimens?
I'm not. I mean, I'm a little swayed when I look at the data. It's all from largely one institute. And then the other issue is that the median age on those trials of FLAG-IDA and FLAG-IDA N were like in the 40s.
Yeah.
The majority of my patients presenting are in their 60s and 70s. So I'm a little hesitant about the toxicity of that regimen. I have considered giving FLAG-IDA ven or FLAG-IDA or FLAG-IDA GO in a young person with, like, for example, somebody who I know has socioeconomic factors, can't come back for consolidation therapy. I have somebody that lives 3 hours away and lives in a trailer, really not coming back to get HIDAC consolidation. So in that person, my best opportunity to get them into a long-term remission would be something like throwing everything in the kitchen sink. And that's the type of patient that I would do FLAG-IDA GO or FLAG-IDA ven. But that's an exception. Majority of my patients still get 7 and 3, and my preference is actually to add a targeted therapy, if possible, on top of the intensive backbone than to just intensify the backbone with a FLAG or a ven. But that's just my personal preference.
Andrew?
So rather than FLAG-IDA ven, what about 7 plus 3 plus ven, which you guys presented that many years ago, and there's an update at this year's ASH. What's your thoughts about reducing the chemotherapy but still incorporating the ven?
I think it's a very exciting regimen. We have, as I briefly showed, we have trials from all over the world now that show that 3 and 7 and ven has a high CR rate, but I think we still need the randomized data. My trial is now closed because we've recruited fully, and I'm not going to give it to patients until I see the randomized data.
A lot of these studies never talk about the post-consolidation thrombocytopenia. It's sort of always conveniently omitted from the publications. After 7 and 3 plus ven, do you have any sense as to how tolerable it is with respect to consolidation and platelet recovery?
Yes, we do. In fact, that'll be on the poster. And there is really no that is really no decrement. We didn't have to. I think in one patient, we had a DLT of prolonged platelet recovery. So it didn't seem to be a problem. Once they were in remission, they were tolerated just fine.
I had a question, and I don't know. Maybe, Eitan, you could help. Does the fact of whether the patient can go to transplant or not play a role in an intensification upfront? Because I've heard people say, oh, I'm going to give flegide-aven to my patient because I'm going to be more likely to get a high CR rate and then get them to transplant, as opposed to somebody that's not transplant eligible.
It's a good hypothesis, but you also might be more likely to kill the patient if you exactly. by intensifying the treatment. Okay. So I think you really have to be careful about that. I think, you know, the road of leukemia treatment is paved with good intentions, and many of the good intentions end up being, unfortunately, end up being not right. I think Andrew had it wiggled.
Hey, Tom, with respect to the flegide-aven, so although that was published to use quite high doses of Ara-C and use 14 days of ven, as Richard presented, in practice, we only use 7 days of ven and a lower dose of Ara-C. In fact, we rarely go above 1 to 1.5 grams per meter squared. What do you do? Do you use the published regimen, or have you modified it?
For flegide-aven?
Yep.
We do not use any venetoclax in combination with intensive chemotherapy.
Maybe you should ask someone else.
In our practice, I'm very conservative, and that leaks out to the faculty members who I see sitting in the audience. My faculty members sitting in the audience. Yeah, Rich.
I just, picking up on what Eunice said, I think the MyeloMatch trials, I didn't say it, but the primary endpoint is MRD negative CR for most of the different subtrials. And so for that will be, if we can get to MRD negative CR, that really should be the goal, especially in people that are thought to need a transplant because they do better with MRD negative CRs. And that's was shown by many of the trials.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of my concerns when you read the flegide-aven papers and then they're compared to historical regimens of flegide is that I think the patient populations are different. So flegide-aven patients, when the institution that did these studies, when you talk to them, the unfavorable risk patients, complex karyotype P53s, are typically prioritized to other studies that are not intensive, things like azaven. So then you're comparing maybe apples to oranges, and maybe, you know, I think Rich mentioned it, if you were to put in P53 mutant patients, would they do as well? I don't know the answer to that. Let's get on to one other question. We have a few more minutes for this chunk, and that's the question of azaven in younger patients. Everyone seems to want to do this, but I think Rich just showed some data suggesting that maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe that's not the right thing. So should we be giving azaven to any younger patient, younger patients with high-risk genetics, or no one at all? Maybe I'll start with Sasha.
Well, we are doing that on a trial that's randomizing this question, and I think that's the proper way to answer this is we don't know the right answer. And who are the patients that are going on this study? Is it every patient who walks in the door? No. If somebody walks in the door with core binding factor AML, they're not allowed on that study. If somebody walks in the door who has a FLT3 mutation, they're not allowed on that study because we think we know a proper way to approach that. And it's not going to be azaven. It's going to be a different way. It's going to be 7-3 with GO or 7-3 with a FLT3 inhibitor. But for everybody else, and in particular the kind of older patients who are still fit, it's a great study to say, you know, we really don't know the right answer. Let's use this to help figure it out. So, yeah, we are doing it on that study. But off study, the people we hem and haw about are those with really adverse genetics where we don't know we're doing them any favor. We know we're going to need to go to a transplant. You have an inversion 3Q. You have a TP53 mutation. We don't have anything good. We'd like to offer a study. Outside of a study, we don't want to harm the patient while we're trying to ready them for transplant and not knowing how much the benefit of an MRD negative state is if the likelihood of achieving that state is vanishingly low.
Rich, where were you going to?
I was going to say that I've seen enough death and lack of efficacy of intensive chemo with high mutant allele fraction P53 that I will not give intensive chemotherapy to even young patients. I will give them ven/aza. Hope that they respond and transplant them. As you showed, as Sasha and colleagues showed, it doesn't seem to matter if they get intensive chemotherapy or not. If they get a transplant, they have a shot. If they don't, they don't. And I'm not going to torture them any more than is necessary.
Andrew?
I think for ELN favorable patients, I definitely wouldn't tinker with those patients because we know that CBF patients with a KIT mutation, they do not do well at all with ven/aza. And for patients with NPM1 mutation, if we start ven/aza, when do we stop? You're committing young people to, you know, a year of ven/aza quality of life problems. And so really the only group would be, you know, borderline fitness, adverse risk, goal is to get them to transplant, and you're worried about the toxicity of chemo, that's probably the only situation we would do that.
Okay, great. Thanks so much. We're going to have to move on right now to the next module, which is going to be Sasha talking about the role of FLT3 inhibitors in the management of AML.
So again, I want to thank Eitan for being a wonderful moderator. Thank Neil Lugv and his whole organization for putting this talk together, and the enduring webinars that will follow this. Going to talk today on the role of targeting FLT3 and just advances in outcomes in patients with FLT3 mutations. Some of this we've already started talking about, so I hopefully can flash through a lot of this data relatively quickly. I think we all know that FLT3 is a very commonly mutated gene in AML. If we look at PCR to detect FLT3 mutations, somewhere around about a third of patients will have a FLT3 mutation, with 20 to 25% of patients having a FLT3 ITD, which is generally associated with a more unfavorable prognosis, and another 5 or 10% having a FLT3 TKD mutation. It's interesting to note that there actually is now enhanced detection of this by more sensitive techniques, and we don't know what the outcome of patients who have these kind of microclones of FLT3 ITD that you can only pick up by next generation sequencing, what that really means. There will actually be a talk on that at this meeting. And during this talk, I'll try to highlight where at the ASH meeting you can learn something new about FLT3, both in terms of its biology and its therapy. There's also these emerging data on whether we should be targeting FLT3 with a drug like quizartinib in patients who lack a FLT3 ITD, which is that drug's target. How do these drugs work? The first developed FLT3 inhibitors were FLT3 inhibitors more by accident than by design, because they were relatively low potency and relatively non-selective drugs. But as single agents, while these drugs did not have a great amount of single agent activity in relapsed and refractory patients who had FLT3 mutations, they quickly moved into combination studies. And actually there they had much greater efficacy. Midostaurin is probably the obvious choice in this setting. And we think that probably what's going on with a drug like that is different than what's happening as a single agent in relapsed refractory patients. So the early drugs were less potent, the later drugs are more potent. And what's notable also is that some of these drugs target FLT3 ITD only, and those are called type 2 inhibitors, and some will target FLT3 ITD or FLT3 TKD mutations, and those are type 2 inhibitors. So, for example, quizartinib is a type 2 inhibitor, midostaurin is a type 1, gilteritinib is a type 1. And lastly, the role of these drugs after transplant is not all that well established from mechanistic studies, but certainly there's a graft versus leukemic effect that may in part have to do with immunomodulatory effects of FLT3. This is the kind of current approach for treating patients with AML, and if you add in these drugs where they are currently approved or commonly used, you can see there's a lot of places that we can add a FLT3 inhibitor, and there are randomized studies that show a benefit here, primarily for using drugs like midostaurin and quizartinib throughout induction, consolidation, and even maintenance, where there are approvals for these drugs in the U.S. and the EU. There's been evidence of benefit for gilteritinib, which I'll talk about in the post-transplant setting, but that seems to be limited to the MRD-positive group. And gilteritinib as a single agent has shown survival benefit as a salvage therapy for relapsed and refractory FLT3 mutant disease. But is there a best drug? Is there like the leader of the pack? Is there one FLT3 inhibitor that rules them all? What's the best FLT3 inhibitor out there? How are we going to solve this conundrum when we have many drugs to choose from? Well, ideally, we would have studies where we can look head-to-head at how these drugs perform against each other. But so far, until this meeting, we really only have placebo-controlled trials. And we have two major ones here, the RATIFY study led by Rich, shown on the left, that showed that midostaurin was successful at improving overall survival in patients under the age of 60, in which midostaurin was added for 14 days to induction consolidation and then a year of maintenance compared to a placebo in patients with either FLT3 ITD or FLT3 TKD. And the Quantum First study, which only enrolled patients with FLT3 ITD mutation, and again, gave the drug for 14 days of each induction cycle, and then each consolidation cycle, and then 3 years of maintenance. What's different about Quantum First is, again, only patients with FLT3 ITD. It also enrolled older patients than RATIFY, and also allowed for FLT3 inhibitor to be given after transplant. Patients didn't leave the study for their transplant. There was no post-transplant maintenance on RATIFY. We now have 10-year follow-up from RATIFY, which will be presented by Rich at this meeting. So go look for that. That's an oral presentation on Saturday. And if we try to look at the outcome here to say, do these tell us, should we use one drug for one patient or another drug for another? Really, all we're left with is midostaurin's active in the TKD-positive patients. And for the FLT3 ITD-positive patients, the overall survivals here actually look very similar. There are some subtle differences here, and you have to tease out the data quite a bit to say, is there really an established better drug here? The remission rates are actually more similar than different across these two studies. Again, there are differences in the patient populations and designs, but they show very similar and consistent findings that the addition of a FLT3 inhibitor to induction consolidation and then maintenance is associated with a little bit higher remission rate, more importantly, a better protection against relapse, and that translates into better survival. If we look at the outcome of patients in the same age group, because Ratify enrolled only up to 60, whereas Quantum First enrolled up to age 75, these are the data overall here, and I'm not going to try to compare right to left here other than to say if we look in the younger patients on Quantum First, which are shown on the right there, the same age group that was shown on the Ratify study, it's a different picture in terms of the potential benefit of quizartinib than what's seen in people over the age of 60, which I show on the left there. So in this subgroup analysis, and take that with a grain of salt, it's less obvious that quizartinib is importing a survival benefit, and I really don't see any difference between those two curves, whereas there seems to be a more impressive difference in the younger patients with quizartinib. I've limited time to talk about MRD, and it's a complicated topic, so I'll try to go through this quickly, other than to say that there is an ability to measure how much residual FLT3 ITD mutation is present when a patient enters remission through next-generation sequencing technology. This is not the next-gen sequencing you order in terms of detecting a FLT3 ITD. This is a specific assay that uses a limited number of PCR cycles to amplify the region of the ITD and then sequence the products. And this has been incorporated into a number of studies, including the Quantum First study. Fortunately, Ratify didn't have MRD data, so we can't use those numbers to compare these two studies. But what you can see on the right is that patients who achieved a deep remission, as measured by this quantitative FLT3 ITD assay, had better survival than patients who had residual ITD, even in remission. And if you try to compare the two study arms here, quizartinib in blue and the placebo in green from Quantum First, you can see that after induction, after two cycles of consolidation, which is a standard time to measure MRD, or at the end of consolidation, there's a deeper level of remission as measured by this ITD quantitative assay in the quizartinib arm, showing that FLT3 inhibitors do lead to deeper remissions. What's also notable is the lowest level of detection here is about 10 to the minus sixth. And at each of these time points, we see a greater number of patients who have undetectable FLT3 ITD in the quizartinib arm, suggesting that really we're eliminating detectable FLT3 ITD much better with the combination. Does this translate into better survival? Does it really matter? If you achieved an MRD negative state, did it matter how you get there? It's interesting to see that across the time points I've shown, if you achieve that optimal, you know, MRD undetectable FLT3 ITD, you did pretty well no matter what treatment arm you were on. But if you were MRD positive, the survival was consistently better in the quizartinib arm, suggesting the ongoing therapy with that drug is particularly important in patients who have persistent MRD. Now, this whole question of persistent MRD, what better way to treat that than transplant? These are the patients we would figure actually should be transplanted if chemotherapy won't cure them. And the big question is, can a FLT3 inhibitor improve upon that? So the MORPHO study done in the U.S. as the BMT-CTN-1506 study was recently published that asked this question as to whether adding a FLT3 inhibitor, in this case gilteritinib, for 2 years after transplant was overall beneficial at preventing relapse and relapse-free survival after transplant, and also which was the population that benefited. Was it all patients or only those who had detectable FLT3 ITD by an MRD assay like I just described? So that was actually measured prior to transplant and that at the time of randomization, which was post-transplant, 1 to 3 months post-transplant. And about 50% of patients had a detectable FLT3 ITD who were enrolled onto this study, with the vast majority of those patients being detectable prior to transplant, about 46%, and a new 5% detected only post-transplant. And as it turns out, the relapse-free survival on this study, which was the primary endpoint, was not statistically significantly better on the gilteritinib arm. That's the curves on the left, which look a little bit better, but the statisticians had set less than 0.05 as the primary endpoint. But what's most notable is really that the relapse-free survival was markedly better and significantly better in the population that was MRD positive at either the pre-transplant or post-transplant time point, suggesting this is the population that really needs post-transplant FLT3 inhibitor, and that all levels of detectable disease imparted a similar kind of effect here. There was always better survival in the gilteritinib arm at any level of FLT3 ITD detection, and that positive group in aggregate. when did these relapses happen post-transplant? They generally happen pretty early, suggesting that if you're going to give maintenance, you can't wait until the patient's 100 days out from transplant before starting this. You actually have to potentially start this much earlier. And the median time to starting gilteritinib on the study was 2 months. So where has gilteritinib also shown benefit? Well, it's approved for relapsed refractory patients, and these are the data that support that approval. In patients with a detectable FLT3 ITD or TKD mutation, about a third of them will go into a CR or CRH when treated with single-agent gilteritinib. And the key question is, should we be waiting in these patients until they are relapsed and refractory, or should we be moving that front line? There's a number of studies that are looking at earlier use of gilteritinib and other FLT3 inhibitors in frontline therapy, and these are actually randomized studies that will compare gilteritinib to midostaurin. There's another study looking at crenolinib versus midostaurin, but unfortunately that stopped enrollment, so we won't get a readout on that, I don't think. There will be presented at this meeting the PRECOG 905 study, which is going to be the first presentation of any randomized data comparing the addition of gilteritinib to the addition of midostaurin, so TKI versus TKI, to see, you know, who's the king of the hill here. And that will be presented by Selena Luger on Saturday at 3. This is a study looking at MRD outcomes on the primary endpoint of that study. A study that will be looking more for survival endpoints, primarily EFS, is coming from Europe, and that will take longer to read out. But the PRECOG study, we are seeing the first data off of that now. And then lastly, in the few minutes that I have left, I just want to throw out the idea that we've discussed a little bit before, so I'll go through it quickly, which is for older patients or those unfit for intensive chemotherapy, we do have targetable mutations, but is it beneficial to add a FLT3 inhibitor frontline? And these are questions that we're still answering in trials. As Andrew said, his group in Australia is doing a study with midostaurin. We in the U.S. are looking at a study, a multicenter study, that'll be looking at this regimen that was developed at MD Anderson, adding gilteritinib to ven/aza, that showed very high remission rates, over 90%, in patients unfit for intensive chemotherapy and very promising protection from relapse. So in the U.S., there'll be a randomized study through MyeloMatch, which there's a trial in progress, a poster from Jessica Altman. This is a study I'm leading with her, and I've also highlighted Andrew's study from Australia below. So just know that these are happening. I'll finish up by just saying these are not the only FLT3 inhibitors out there. There are a handful of other agents that are being looked at, both in FLT3 mutated patients and also in patients with wild type FLT3. Drugs that target not only FLT3, but other targets such as FLT3 and JAK or IRAK4. And other ways that we can inhibit FLT3, such as covalent inhibitors, have already entered trials, with now the Fujifilm drug being published and the Biomea drug being in early phase studies. The menin inhibitors have just been approved in NPM1 mutant disease, which Eytan will talk more fully about. Many patients with FLT3 mutations have NPM1 mutations, so there's an obvious combination approach that will need to be tested in trials. And lastly, I'll just throw out that the wild-type study that quizartinib is looking at is something that I think a lot of people are finding interesting, but we need real data to answer. So these are some of the studies to look for at this meeting. And just in conclusion, I think it's a very exciting time that we have more data to actually make decisions in the FLT3 world. And so with that, I think we'll move on to the discussion.
Okay, we're going to go down the row here, and I'm going to give you a hypothetical case. I want to hear what you would say. The hypothetical case is this. 35-year-old woman comes to your clinic, newly diagnosed AML, NPM1 mutation, FLT3 ITD. You're going to give the patient 7 and 3. Which FLT3 inhibitor are you going to use, quizartinib or midostaurin? Eunice.
I'm going to use quizartinib.
Okay. Why?
Why? Because of the quantum first data. I think that the most potent inhibitor for FLT3 ITD is quizartinib, and there was a survival advantage. And I think that this 35-year-old has no contraindication to the use of a quizartinib drug. Of the major side effects that we see that preclude the use of quizartinib in the upfront setting include interactions with QT prolonging drugs, which you did not mention, azoles, which we certainly could substitute for. She doesn't have any comorbidities that would preclude her, and I do believe that that's the best FLT3 inhibitor for her.
Okay, that's a persuasive argument. Sasha, what about you?
I would basically say the same thing. I think this is an ideal patient for quizartinib. There will be some presentation of data on mutational subsets and their outcomes from the QuantiFirst study that Mark Levis will be presenting. I forget if it's Saturday or Sunday. And actually, the NPM1 mutant group had a superb outcome on that study. And notably, the combination of DNMT3A and NPM1, which generally does very poorly if they don't get a FLT3 inhibitor, was one of the best outcomes on that study, really superior outcomes with quizartinib. And again, I don't see any contraindication to using what is, in my mind, a more potent and potentially better FLT3 inhibitor here.
Okay, Rich?
I agree.
Rich agrees. Okay, Andrew?
I do agree, but my question to the panel again is, in the double mutant population, if patients are achieving MRD negativity, I noticed there are some colleagues who are not allografting anymore. We are still allografting all patients with FLT3 ITD, but I'd really like to test the waters here, maybe starting with you, Eytan. Is allografting always necessary still for ITD, even if MRD negative in intermediate risk patients?
Yeah, so I'm going to answer my own question before I answer your question. I actually would use midostaurin, because as I said, we still use midostaurin at Memorial Sloan Kettering. Obviously, you can use quizartinib if you want to, but I'm not convinced that when you look at the primary data, the quizartinib leads to that most important thing, which is a benefit in overall survival. I mean, in full disclosure, I still start my CML patients on imatinib. So, you know, I am a little bit conservative. Your question was, I think, based on some recently published data showing that if you are MRD negative for FLT3 ITD, then maybe you don't need a transplant. Maybe you are cured without a transplant. I think we are still transplant. I think that is one data set. It's so ingrained in us to transplant our FLT3 ITD patients that I'm not convinced yet in a retrospective study, which is what this was, that we should be changing practice. So I'm still transplanting my patients with FLT3 ITD and NPM1, and dual NPM1 mutant, FLT3 ITD mutant with negativity for both, but I could see that changing relatively soon. Sasha, you had a...
All right. I just had two patients that have this issue in my clinic right at the same point, and I think you have to be really careful how you define this. Both patients had a detectable FLT3 ITD, but one, it was detectable easily by a PCR, and it had an allelic ratio of, I think, like 0.5 or so. And the other patient, it was only detectable on our next gen at the tiniest little blip where they saw it, and we didn't even see it by PCR. And that patient had a FLT3 TKD or something like that, and so got midostaurin, so I do use midostaurin in a patient who had a detectable ITD, but in that setting, I think the benefit would be unclear to use quizartinib because the DKD is positive. These patients each went into an NPM1 undetectable remission after two courses of chemotherapy, which was the time point that was looked at in the UK study, in the peripheral blood. And I also did a marrow at that point to say what's going on. And in one patient, the FLT3 ITD is completely undetectable, and the other patient, it's detectable. So I have a patient who's MRD negative for NPM1, but MRD positive for FLT3 ITD. And I think in that setting, you've got to be conservative and say, we think this is a patient at significantly increased risk of relapse if they don't get transplanted. The big question is, would you have adequate salvage? Can we rely on venetoclax combinations or gilteritinib combinations or something if this patient relapses, or, you know, eventually we'll say, you know, can we give revumenib or something like that? We can have an argument about what the best salvage for NPM1 is, but in that setting, if you're comfortable saying I can salvage you and 100% get you to a transplant, the UK was saying that they had a good enough salvage rate to, you know, avoid going to transplant because less than 40% of their patients relapse, but there was still a pretty high rate of relapse. We are transplanting that patient who's MRD positive for FLT3 ITD. I am not transplanting the other patient who's undetectable for both markers.
Hey, Rich?
Yeah, I don't think we know how to, you're referring, both of you guys have been referring to the Othman study, which showed that retrospectively, largely before the era of FLT3 inhibitors, if you were MRD negative for NPM1, you didn't need a transplant regardless of whether you had a FLT3 mutation. We don't know anything about this FLT3 assay that you were talking about in that setting or in many settings other than the Morpho trial. So I would say it's a very individualized discussion. I think in the era of FLT3 inhibitors, it's likely that the FLT3 mutant patients are going to be even more likely to be MRD negative. So to me, unless the patient is completely fit and for some reason there's some other reason to transplant them, I cautiously measure their MRD after the consolidation and will not transplant such a patient. Remember, transplantation is not a walk in the park.
Oh, yeah.
So just so I understand, so this is the patient you're describing is NPM1 mutant, yeah. FLT3-ITD positive.
At the start.
Post-induction, a cycle of consolidation, they're NPM1
negative
for by PCR, and yeah. FLT3-ITD, you know the
status? Don't know the study, can't get it. The company will not allow us to do it in a financially easy fashion, so we do not measure we do not have access to the trial.
We have a New York State issue where we don't have access
either. Well, we discussed this with you, and neither of us have it, so.
Yeah, so but that patient, you would not, 35-year-old patient, you would not transplant up front.
I would have a discussion and go over the data with her, and I would suggest to her that if she wanted to avoid transplant, it was reasonable to do so.
Okay.
I still transplant them. I'm conservative, though not maybe as conservative as you, because I would give quizartinib. But when you look at the data, particularly for like quizartinib, NPM1, DMNT3A, those patients do very, very well with quizartinib in the Quantum First trial. In fact, even in the absence of transplant. But I do think that for a 35-year-old, I'm looking at 30, 40, 50 more years. And I think that I would offer transplant in CR1 still as the standard of care. Yes, there may be some that would be able to avoid it if they're NPM1 negative. However, I'm looking long term, and I think at some point there is a significant chance that the disease is going to rear its ugly head, and we may have lost the opportunity for curative intent.
Hey, Andrew, you asked the question, so you get the last word.
I've always wondered, for people that have 7-3 mito or 7-3 quiz, if they don't go into remission on the first go, Richard, I'm not sure if you ever published what happened to those 25% of patients that got 7-3 mito again, and I presume the quiz study also gave 7-3 with quiz. Is that what you actually do, or do you switch straight away to gilteritinib?
You didn't answer your question yet. You didn't answer the question. I just want to point that out.
Okay, you answer, Richard, and then we'll make him put his torch on fire.
You asked a different question. I will answer that question as best I can, which is that the need for a second remission, a second induction cycle, was pretty low in the mitostorin arm, so I really can't answer the question.
Okay, you get to answer your question, Andrew, and then
what was the question again?
The question was, what would you do?
NPM1.
I thought I answered that one first.
No, you said you asked it.
You asked
people are doing that.
Right, the guy who asked it thinks he answered it. 35-year-old, yep. NPM1 positive, FLT3-ITD positive, induction consolidation, now NPM1 negative by RT-PCR, transplant or no transplant?
I think for a 35-year-old, because we know that in particularly the RATIFY trial, most of the benefit was post-allograft. I feel that we don't yet have enough data to not do the allograft, even if MRD negative, because we haven't really done the studies to that level of detail with the proper MRD assay. So, yeah.
Do you think we need last question, I know we're going to be over in a second. Do we need a prospective randomized trial instead of the retrospective work by Othman to answer this question? Anyone want to take that?
I think doing randomized trials for transplant are hard.
Yeah.
I think that's been that would be great. We've always said we want to randomize against transplant. It's extremely difficult to do. Nowadays, it may not be, because with post-transplant Cy, you are able to find donors, but hard question.
So you would want to do it, but logistically, it might be difficult. Any other opinions?
I would want to apply the assay that Sasha mentioned to try to figure this out, because a subset of a subset that may be even retrospectively.
Yeah.
In the patient that you talked about, if their bone marrow is negative by this very sensitive assay, whereas they were maybe had a reasonably high allelic ratio at the start, I would seriously consider not transplanting that patient if the data bore that out. Whereas, obviously, if they're MRD positive for FLT3 by whatever technology you have, I'd be concerned and would do the transplant and then give them the gilteritinib afterwards like you did.
Okay, like on NPR, 30 seconds, last word, Andrew.
What we do know is that every time a patient has relapsing disease, there is clonal evolution, and therefore it's a much more complex disease. And the older the patient is, the more likely we're going to have clonal evolution. So I think the older the patient is, the less likely I'm feeling confident about salvaging and even going to transplant, because it is not the same disease.
Okay, thanks so much. I'm going to talk briefly about the incorporation of IDH inhibitors into the care of patients with acute myeloid leukemia. I want to first point out about the burden of IDH mutations in patients with acute myeloid leukemia. You can see in this work that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2013 that the most frequent mutations that we see are FLT3, NPM1, and DNMT3A. That's not percentages on the left, just to be clear. That's the number of samples in this large data set. But if you stack the IDH2 and the IDH1 on top of one another, you can see that it causes a significant burden of disease. You know, IDH2 and IDH1 are interesting because targeting IDH2 and IDH1 as a therapeutic strategy was the first evidence that a differentiation therapy for acute myeloid leukemia could work since the advent of ATRA and arsenic trioxide. You will all remember that the normal reaction is to convert isocitrate to alpha-ketoglutarate, and those mutant enzymes, whether IDH1 or IDH2, lead to the production of something called an oncometabolite, which is known as 2-HG, which blocks myeloid differentiation. And by targeting the mutant enzyme, you lower levels of 2-HG, which allows myeloid differentiation to occur. I want to show you first some data for relapsed and refractory acute myeloid leukemia, here with IDH1 mutations. I'm only not showing you any survival curves because I actually think it's inappropriate, because that's not what the approval was based on, and they were only phase 2 single-arm trials. It's unclear what survival curves mean in a single-arm phase 2 trial, other than that you didn't compare it to something else. So the basis of the approval for the IDH1 inhibitor ivosidenib for relapsed and refractory IDH1 mutant AML was a single-arm phase 2 study. The approval was based on a CR and CRh rate of 32.8% with a duration of response of 8.2 months. Olutasidenib, which is a newer IDH1 inhibitor, was also approved based on a single-arm phase 2 study, CR-CRh rate of 35%, and a duration of response of almost 26 months. All of you can do some math, and you will notice that this is much longer than what we saw with ivosidenib. In the discussion that the FDA published on how to think about this difference between olutasidenib and ivosidenib, I pasted it in here, you can see that it says that the overall efficacy results seem similar, although no firm conclusions can be made on cross-trial comparisons. Duration of response should not be compared across studies because of differences in both measured and unmeasured confounders, as well as differences in the median duration of follow-up. So it's a little tough, right? My eyes say olutasidenib is much, much better. The FDA seems to say, don't trust what you're seeing in the data because of confounding factors. I personally actually like what the FDA has to say, because those unmeasured confounding factors really, I think, can significantly impair what to do and what the truth is. So how do I actually decide what drug I'm going to use with IDH1 mutations for relapsed and refractory IDH1 mutant acute myeloid leukemia? Well, I actually look at the side effect profile. Ivosidenib has a side effect profile where it causes QT prolongation of any grade in 26% of patients and a grade 3 in 10% of patients, and differentiation syndrome is seen grade 3 or higher in 13% of patients. Olutasidenib does not cause QT prolongation. It does cause a transaminitis, with 12% of the patients having a grade 3 or higher transaminitis, and the rate of differentiation syndrome being roughly equivalent to what is seen in patients who receive ivosidenib. What about going to the IDH2 inhibitor enasidenib? So there's only one IDH2 inhibitor approved for relapsed and refractory acute myeloid leukemia. Again, approved on the basis of a single-arm phase 2 trial with a CR-CRh rate of 23%, duration of response of 8.2 months. Many people forget that there was actually a randomized phase 3 trial comparing, and after this approval, because that's what they had to do, comparing enasidenib to what is known as conventional care regimens. That's what's found over here. Conventional care regimens consisted of azacitidine, intermediate dose Ara-C, or low dose Ara-C, with the primary endpoint of the study being overall survival. And on the right-hand side, you can see that while the median event-free survival and the median time to treatment failure was actually longer with enasidenib, the median overall survival was roughly the same between enasidenib and conventional care regimens. So does this mean I don't use enasidenib? Of course not. I use enasidenib all the time. And that's because I think this trial had some significant issues when you look at the rate of dropout between the two arms. Approximately 50 to 60 patients on the conventional care regimen dropped out very early from the study, likely to go on and receive enasidenib that they could get through another source. So I think the applicability and generalizability of this study to the broader use of enasidenib is still an open question. What about giving IDH inhibitors in combination with chemotherapy? We ran a clinical trial a number of years ago. Courtney DiNardo and I led this trial combining ivosidenib or enasidenib with intensive chemotherapy. You can see on the bottom left the response rates at any time, with the response rates actually being quite high, whether the patients had de novo AML or secondary acute myeloid leukemia. And if you look at the survival curves with ivosidenib in blue and enasidenib in red, what you can see is that those patients, this wasn't to compare one to the other, we just put the survival on the same Kaplan-Meier curve, you can see the overall survival out at 30 months is actually quite good and very impressive. And that's what led to this randomized phase 3 HOVON trial, which is a placebo-controlled trial of intensive chemotherapy with ivosidenib or enasidenib, if you're IDH1 or IDH2, versus intensive chemotherapy with placebo. And I'm very, very pleased to announce, not that I had anything to do with it, but I'll announce it anyway, that this trial is actually now fully accrued. It has accrued 974 patients. It's close to accrual, and we expect to have some results out in 2027 or 2028, which hopefully will answer the question whether adding an IDH inhibitor to intensive chemotherapy is better than intensive chemotherapy alone. Just very briefly in the last few minutes, ivosidenib is also approved as a single agent for newly diagnosed acute myeloid leukemia with an IDH1 mutation. I might consider this in a very, very elderly patient who is of a very poor performance status and can't tolerate anything else. You can see that this data was based on 33 patients with a CR/CRh rate of 42.4%, CR rate of 30.3%, and a CRh rate of 12.1%. We also published a study a year or two ago, actually it was this year, looking at the risk-adapted use of enasidenib for duly diagnosed AML. This was part of the BEAT AML clinical trial portfolio, where we took newly diagnosed IDH2 mutant patients, gave them enasidenib monotherapy for up to 5 cycles. Patients who did not achieve a CR or CRI would then get AZA added on to the enasidenib after the 5th cycle. Of course, patients who achieved a CR or CRI continued enasidenib monotherapy. You can see that phase 2, which is the enasidenib monotherapy arm, had actually quite high response rates with a rate of composite complete remission of 48%, true CR rate of 37%, CRh of 8%, CRi of 3%. And of those 17 patients who did not achieve a complete remission with enasidenib monotherapy, the addition of azacitidine led to an additional 6 patients who achieved a CR or CRh. If you do the math, it ends up being 36% of the patients. Again, this is investigational. I don't do it off study, but I think it is interesting to see that you don't necessarily have to start with 2 agents together. You can give agents in sequence and still get salvage when you're an enasidenib failure. Okay, finally, this is something that Andrew talked about in his presentation, the AGILE study, a double-blind randomized placebo-controlled trial of ivosidenib with azacitidine or placebo with azacitidine. The primary endpoint was event-free survival. Key secondary endpoints were overall survival. Just to go through this very quickly, the overall response rate, which is actually at the bottom right, was quite high, with the overall response rate being higher in the ivosidenib and azacitidine arm than in the placebo and azacitidine arm. Most of that was because of a significantly higher rate of complete remission and complete remission with partial hematologic recovery. And what this translated into are these very, very impressive overall survival curves, where ivo-aza has a median overall survival of 29.3 months and placebo-aza has a median overall survival of 7.9 months. Finally, I want to take, in my last 26 seconds, I want to talk about triplets. Triplets is something that I like to talk about. So I like talking about triplets because there is an idea in cancer that more is better. And I have heard people say from podiums like this, is it podia or podiums? Yeah. Not sure. but I'm going to say podiums, from podiums like this, that we should be like multiple myeloma and be having quintuplets and sextuplets and, you know, all sorts of combinations. The problem in acute myeloid leukemia is that you can't give triplet and quadruplet and quintuplet therapy if it is adding myelosuppression. Because if you add myelosuppression, you will end up killing your patient. In multiple myeloma clinical trials, the minute the platelet count drops below 50, the patient is off the study. Of course, that doesn't happen in AML clinical trials. Having said that, this triplet combination of AZA, IVO, and VEN in patients with newly diagnosed IDH1 mutant acute myeloid leukemia shows very, very impressive overall response rates in the range of 100% when you do the triplet. The question becomes what happens after that cycle one and cycle two and after the patient gets into a CR. And I would advocate, although it's not going to be the easiest trial to do, that we need randomized controlled trials really for all triplets that are given as well, and not just accept data based and change practice based on single arm phase two studies. So in conclusion, IDH inhibitors are really firmly established as beneficial treatment options for IDH1 or IDH2 mutant disease. We talked about the randomized phase three enasidenib versus conventional care option. We talked about how I choose to use ivosidenib or olutasidenib, and it's primarily based on the side effect profile and the patient standing in front of me. We know the combination of IVO and enasidenib with chemotherapy is safe. Efficacy is being investigated in the HOVON placebo-controlled phase three trial. I think IVO-AZA for newly diagnosed IDH1 mutant AML is a standard of care. Should it be the standard of care? We can discuss that. And the benefits of triplets I just ranted about 30 seconds ago. So with that, let's move on to some questions. Let's get to the number one question. I'm so happy I don't have to answer all the questions up here because I'm asking them. So I'm going to ask Andrew first. Andrew, you are a leader in the field of venetoclax. If you have an ID, you're a leader in the field of a lot of things, but venetoclax is one of your things. If you have an IDH1 mutant patient in front of you who is 83 years old, do you give them azacitidine venetoclax or azacitidine ivosidenib? And why?
So with a patient that progresses off Ven-Aza with an IDH1 mutation, I have seen really late relapses off Azaven. So there are patients where we've stopped Azaven, and 5 years out from remission, you know, we're thinking this patient's cured, they relapse. And often this is due to a persistent pre-leukemic IDH mutation, which presumably has spawned a new AML. Obviously, we would use an IDH inhibitor. And I do like the idea of combining it with venetoclax, because I think, you know, you showed in the frontline setting that was a particularly potent combination, almost as good as the triplet. Whereas with AZA, I feel it's sort of going back to more cytotoxic-based therapy with more uncertainty. And we know that AZA in the relapse setting really isn't as effective as some of the new targeted drugs.
Okay. Does the goal of, you know, now we're transplanting older and older patients.
Yeah.
Does the goal of where you're trying to get that patient influence whether you might give an IDH1 mutant patient IVO-AZA or VEN-AZA? Meaning, if a patient might, you, if you have a 72-year-old and 73-year-old in front of you with an IDH1 mutation, you want to get them to an allogeneic stem cell transplant, let's say. Does that influence which treatment you use, which doublet you
use? I am actually not aware of any data giving IVO-AZA followed by transplant. I don't think anybody's published that. There are data for VEN-AZA followed by transplant. They actually look pretty good. We've shown some of those from our retrospective analysis of Penn experience and Flatiron that Andy Matthews put together. And we're one of many data sets that have shown that. And they're all fairly consistent. They look pretty much as good as intensive chemotherapy. I don't know if that's indeed the case for IVO-AZA. It probably is, but I don't know. So if I'm thinking going to transplant, I'm generally going to use VEN-AZA. In somebody that I think has likely poor tolerance of induction therapy, but if they get a better performance status or one thing or another, that they could go eventually to a transplant later on. And that's a lot of our patients around the age of 70 or a little over the age of 70.
You know, Eunice, I don't know if you've seen this, but there's been some retrospective data, maybe for all of you, that suggests that the sequencing makes a difference. I guess, do you think we should maybe if you know, like, what do you think about that data, and what should we be doing with it in practice?
So, I mean, I think that when patients develop or they progress on Venia, so first of all, I've never cured anybody with Venia alone. Everybody recurs at some point or has becomes more and more myelosuppressed and actually has a complication. So anyway, given that, when patients fail Ven-Aza for AML in the upfront setting, the data suggests their overall survival when they progress or fail is very short, like in the range of 3 to 5 months. And there is small retrospective case series that have been done looking at sequencing. And the MD Anderson group published this first a few years ago. They took their patients progressing on Ven-Aza. They went and characterized whether they had IDH mutations, FLT3 mutations, and they tried targeted therapy as a salvage after Ven-Aza. And they also had horrible response rates, like 20-30%. And there's whole lectures on the development of Ven-Aza and how to overcome that. And I know Dr. Wei is involved in. And so anecdotally in these case series, if you start with Ven-Aza and you're resistant and you try targeted therapy, you don't do well, 20-30%. However, in these case series, if you start with Aza-Ivo, or you start with a FLT3-based, or you start with a targeted therapy like Ivo-Aza, and then you'd fail that, you can salvage them with Ven-Aza. And part of the rationale is that when you become resistant to BCL2 inhibitor, you develop a pan resistance that makes you resistant to everything. Whereas if you develop a resistance to Ivo-Aza, you can still save them with the BCL2 inhibitor. So for that reason, for patients that are not transplant eligible, and the response rates were much higher, 60, 70, 80% salvage with of a targeted therapy. So for that reason, in our center, we typically would start in IDH1 mutant patient who does not have a transplant option, elderly, as you said, on Avo-Izo. And then if they progress, save the Ven-Aza as a pan-salvage regimen. And ideally, they would not recur after Aza-Ivo for several years. And then you would have the option potentially of giving Ven-Aza, or nowadays you actually have a olutasidenib.
Rich?
I have a comment. I really like the data you showed with the triplet. I think we'll be using triplets. There'll be an abstract presented by a fellow from MD Anderson that Dr. Garcia at my institution also participated in, where the response rate is extremely high and the toxicity is very good, low. Number two, I have a question for you, though, coming back to that. Would the IDH inhibitors have been approved in the post-Aza-Ven era based on what Eunice was just talking about? In other words, the response rate would have been a lot lower if all the patients had relapsed after Aza-Ven instead of just Aza alone.
Possibly not. Possibly not. Which would have been a shame, actually, yeah. Right? So,
right.
Because what would have happened is they wouldn't have been approved, and then no one would have, people would have killed the program, and then they wouldn't have been used up front, and then we would have lost a lot. So I think it would have been
just
a shame.
Just make that point to show how we go on knife's edge here sometimes.
Yeah. What about, Rich, just sticking with you, what about IDH inhibitors as maintenance post-transplant? They're small prospective series. Do you do that at your institution?
No, we don't routinely. Although I think the genetic milieu is going to be kind of complicated, and I don't think we have enough data to justify spending that money at this point. For that reason, we need a trial.
I actually wanted to get back, since I don't want to talk about IDH and ask a lot of questions, get back to Sasha about the maintenance FLT3 inhibitor.
Yeah.
Maintenance gilteritinib. Are you giving it, how are you choosing who to give maintenance FLT3 inhibitors to post-transplant? Are you sticking to what was done in the trial?
I mean, I think the trial gives pretty compelling data to say that the population of benefit are those who have a detectable FLT3 ITD either right prior to transplant or in the early pre-transplant period. And I showed the data on, you know, the speed of relapses. If you look at the control arm there, the relapse rate for patients who are MRD positive is not 100% for the control arm. There is a graft versus leukemic effect. So MRD positive patients can be cured with transplant alone, but they're just a lot more likely to be cured if they got gilteritinib maintenance. So that says to me, this is an important therapy. And that may actually be more important than what preparative regimen you give. Is it reduced intensity? Is it myeloablative? And there'll be endless discussions about, you know, how to parse through remaining data. But I think the simple answer is if you're convinced the patient needs a transplant and they still have detectable disease going into transplant, there's, you know, a randomized study showing a benefit for a FLT3 inhibitor. And it's for gilteritinib, so that's the drug I'm choosing.
By the way, do you stop at 2 years with the I know that's because...
Great question.
In the Ratify trial, those people who stopped the FLT3 inhibitor relapsed after they stopped. Some did relapse after
they
stopped.
We looked at that. And when we looked at the patients who, you know, at the end of their 2 years were still MRD positive and then stopped their drug, ba-boom, they relapsed very quickly, not surprisingly. What's the outcome of people who got longer than that? We don't have data. But I would generally say they need more
therapy.
Do you
give DLI to that patient or just keep them on Midostaurin?
I think they need DLI, and I wouldn't wait 2 years to do it. Yeah. I would track that. And the theme here is just we need to monitor MRD to know how best to treat our patients.
Andrew?
Hey, Tom, in Australia, we don't yet have access to frontline over Sydney, but when you showed the long-term agile data, there isn't quite a plateau yet, so presumably people are still relapsing. So with people on AZA IVO and doing well, let's say IDH1 negative, are you stopping the therapy? Are you using single agent IVO for life? Or what are you doing in a health economically constrained world?
Yeah, it's a really tough question. I mean, we actually, I just had a patient like this, I think what we struggle with is when we're doing our testing for IDH1, residual IDH1 mutations, it's typically not a very sensitive test. It's a standard next-generation sequencing assay. I think if we were doing digital droplet PCR and we got a negative result, I would consider stopping the IDH1 inhibitor. Okay, I got told in my ear a fun fact that according to Merriam-Webster, podiums or podia are both acceptable. Ooh. So you guys have just learned something at the end of the day. Okay, we're now going to move on to a talk I'm really looking forward to. Dr. Wang's going to talk about the potential role of menin inhibitors and other novel agents in the treatment of acute myeloid leukemia.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Stein, as well as Dr. Neil Love and the organizers of this symposium for allowing me to speak during this ASH Satellite Symposium. The title of my talk is Potential Role of Menin Inhibitors and Other Novel Agents in the Treatment of AML. And I was pleased to see this was the number one requested topic in the initial survey that you provided. So what is menin inhibition and how does menin inhibition work? Why is it restricted only to KMT2A rearranged and NPM1 mutant AML? And what is the potential for it to be used in the future? So just for those of you who are not familiar with the mechanism, in about 5 or 10% of acute leukemias, both AML as well as ALL and mixed phenotype, there is a rearrangement between chromosome 11, 11q23, involving the KMT2A, formerly the MLL gene, with a fusion partner. The combination of the translocation of 11q23 with a fusion partner results in a KMT rearranged epigenomic complex, as you can see here, that then binds to chromatin and regulates the upregulation of transcription factors. Here we see HOXA9 and MEIS1. These particular factors drive a gene expression profile that focuses on leukemic stem cell renewal. It inhibits myeloid differentiation, and it results in proliferation and leukemiogenesis. The menin inhibitor, what is menin? Menin is derived from the MEN1 gene, which is a germline mutation found in patients with multiple endocrine neoplasm 1. The menin protein is a scaffold protein that's actively involved in epigenetic and regulation of transcription. And this binding of this menin protein to the KMT2A protein complex activates the KMT2 complex and drives leukemiogenesis. And so it's specifically found in KMT2A rearranged leukemias. But interestingly enough, the mutant NPM1, which goes from the nucleus to the cytoplasm, also interacts with the KMT2 complex to drive the same biology and function as an oncogene in NPM1 mutant patients. And so in these patients, they have a similar gene expression profile, and inhibition of the menin protein-protein interaction leads to similar effects in that particular subset. There are other subsets of leukemia that have the same profile. Currently, there are multiple menin mutations in clinical development. I've put up the data with the leading five for which we have clinical trial data on them. And obviously the top candidate, revumenib, was approved by the FDA in November 15th of this year. You can see here that was based on another phase two single agent study in patients with relapsed refractory KMT2A. You see that the second candidate in clinical development is ziftomenib, who is pursuing a phase two in NPM1 mutant AML. And there, quickly on the heels of these two agents, are two newer inhibitors, bleximenib and enzomenib, as well as a covalent menin inhibitor, BMF-219. Now, there are clear differences between these menin inhibitors. Shown here is the chemical structures. You can see that revumenib and ziftomenib are what we call pyrimidines. I didn't really pass organic chemistry somehow, but and there is some similarity between those first-generation inhibitors, whereas bleximenib and enzomenib share more structural similarities than the rest, and BMF-219 is a completely different chemical structure. Each of these agents has significant differences in their half-life as well as tissue penetration, which may account for some of the differences that we're seeing in clinical trial usage. All of these inhibitors potently inhibit protein-protein binding of menin to the KMT2A transcriptome complex, and they all have very similar inhibitory properties. As you can see here, the compounds and the bindings, a similar 50% inhibitory concentrations in vitro ranging from 0.49 to 9.2, which is theoretically similar enough that they shouldn't really be one clear candidate as the best menin inhibitor, just as we don't have a clear candidate for the best FLT3 inhibitor. Revumenib, first approved menin inhibitor, again, November 15th, 2024. Shown here are the indications for which it's approved. It's a first-in-class oral selective inhibitor that disrupts the menin-KMT reinteraction, approved for use in both adult and pediatric patients 1 year and older who have KMT2A rearrangements only in the relapse refractory setting. This was based on the results of the AUGMENT-101 study led by my colleague, Dr. Stein, and colleagues here. And then this phase two single agent study, similar to the IDH inhibitor studies, there was approval based on the efficacy as well as the tolerability of this agent. Shown here is the patient characteristics for both the 57 patients that met up the efficacy population as well as the 94 patients that met up the safety population. You can see this was for both pediatric and adult patients. About 20% of patients were primary refractory. There was about 80%, 83 to 86% were AML patients. There were very small numbers of ALL patients here, as well as very small numbers of pediatric patients. The majority of patients had anywhere between 1 and 3 rounds of therapy prior transplant, and half of these patients prior venetoclax in 70%. Shown here are the adverse events, and you can see I've highlighted the ones of specific significance. Differentiation syndrome is an on-target expected toxicity of menin inhibitors based on the mechanism of action of these drugs. You can see about 26 patients, 28% of patients had evidence of some differentiation syndrome, 16% of which was grade 3 and above, QTC prolongation happening in about a quarter of patients with significant prolongation in 14%. In the phase 1 study, the QTC prolongation was the dose-limiting toxicity. I would highlight that there also is heme toxicities, neutropenia in a small proportion of patients. What was the efficacy of revumenib in the AUGMENT-101 study? Shown here, we see an overall response rate meeting any clinical activity in 63% of patients. The true CR rate, however, was only 18%, CRH rate 5%, CRI about 2%. So the CR-CRH rate occurred in about 23% of patients, which is similar to what we're seeing with the IDH1 inhibitors. You can see the majority or 70% of these were MRD negative. The median duration of CR-CRH was 6.4 months with the median survival of 8 months. But we need to point out here that about 43% of patients proceeded on to hematopoietic stem cell transplantation with evidence of clinical activity. So again, in the same range as we saw for approval of agents such as gilteritinib and IDH1, IDH2 inhibitors. However, as shown here by Dr. Stein's data as well, patients quickly developed recurrence. So these are an example of four patients who were treated on revumenib on therapy, and you can see that at the time that they had blast recurrence and had evidence of disease progression, after several months of response on revumenib therapy, a proportion of these patients were found to have mutations in the menin gene. And you can see here that these 39% of patients who had any detectable disease by digital PCR had these mutations occur during therapy. They were not present at the time of screening. And in a survey of the clinically available menin inhibitors in development, Perner and colleagues looked at four different menin mutations, the most common of which here are the T349M. You can see that the red boxes suggest that the particular agent is not sensitive to the inhibitor, and the blue boxes suggest that they are. So certainly there are, among these four known menin mutations, there are some differences in vitro assays only, demonstrating that there may be some differences in their ability to overcome resistance mutations. The second menin inhibitor in clinical development is ziftomenin, shown here. This is early results of their phase 1b study that had focused mostly on NPM1 mutant patients because of a high incidence of differentiation syndrome in patients with KMT rearrangement. You can see here 20% of NPM1 mutant relapse patients had evidence of differentiation syndrome, and these were manageable with risk mitigation strategies. In contrast to ziftomenib, there did not appear to be any QTC prolongation, and not mentioned previously, but there did not seem to be any interaction with azoles, which was a characteristic of revumenib requiring 50% dose reduction in those patients. Shown here are the initial responses on 20 patients with NPM1 mutant disease, with a CR rate of 35%, CRC rate of 40%, and some patients achieving responses that were durable even at low doses of therapy. There was evidence of one menin mutation, which was discovered in 1 out of 29 patients, and so we need to really further examine the clinical development of mutations on these patients. There is an entire session devoted in AML to menin inhibitors during this conference. I encourage you all to go there. There is data on the newest inhibitors in the discussion here, bleximenib, which in vitro overcomes many of the resistance mutations. Differentiation syndrome seems to be a little bit less, in the range of 12% in phase 1, and similar efficacy in KMT2A and NPM1 mutant disease. Enzomenin from Sumitomo, again, seems to, in phase 1 studies, has no dose-limiting toxicity, no QTC interactions, no azole interactions, and again, response rates that mimic are potentially even better than we saw with some of the other agents. So shown here is a summary slide that you can purview in your slide collection that summarizes the results of the four agents, the menin inhibitors that have been studied to date. These have been studied in various patient populations, phase 1, phase 2 data. You can see across the board CR, CRH rates of 20%, overall response rate ranging from 50 to 60%. So guys, these agents are real. What are the adverse events we are interested in? They vary across the inhibitor. Azole interactions, QTC prolongation with revumenib, differentiation syndrome with ziftomenib. We'll have to wait to see what the data is with the other ones. All of them have some degree of febrile neutropenia as well, and we'll need to wait and compare between agents. There is also emerging data on combination therapy, triplet therapy, with response rates reported in up to 100% of patients with persistent issues with differentiation and QTC prolongation. There are novel agents, just want to mention at the end. This is an antibody drug conjugate with a CD123 that has again been studied in triplet therapy. This is a drug that has been studied in BPDCN as well, with very, very high response rates in triplets, as well as newer tyrosine kinase inhibitors. Here's a pan inhibitor, a FLT3-SYK, KIT, and JAK, which has shown some promising activity even in patients who have received prior ven-aza. So in summary, menin inhibitors remain the newest class of targeted therapy for AML. We're also looking at further development of a novel ADCs and novel TKIs moving forward. Thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, that was great. I'm going to steal some of those slides for some of my talks. That was great, especially the summary slides. So, revumenib is now approved. I guess my question is for you, now that revumenib is approved, if you have a relapsed and refractory NPM1 mutant patient, would you try to get that patient, not a FLT3 ITD, would you try to get that patient revumenib off-label?
For right now, I'm enrolling patients on clinical trials.
Okay, fair.
I think that revumenib is conducting a phase 2 single-agent study in NPM1 mutant disease. So preliminarily, there may be differences. I mean, the ziftomenib across the board, and they will be presenting their combination data at this meeting, both in 7 and 3, as well as ven-aza combos, continues to result in high response rates in NPM1. And I don't know whether there's something unique to that drug. It could be the pharmacokinetics that supposedly has better tissue accumulation and penetration. And there were very few patients studied who had NPM1 mutant disease in the phase 1 of revumenib. So I think I have to...
I'll ask the question in a different way, maybe to Sasha, which is, what would you advise someone who doesn't have, because I agree, of course, you want to enroll patients on a trial. But if you don't have access to a trial and you're in a place that you've got a drug you can write a prescription for off-label, do you think the data's there to give revumenib for NPM1 mutant relapsed and refractory disease, or what would you do?
Does the patient have a FLT3 mutation?
The patient does not have a FLT3 mutation because that would be an easy out.
You're correct. If they have a FLT3 mutation, the simple answer is we have a survival benefit for gilteritinib. That's the drug of choice as first salvage. If somebody gets second salvage, I think the data show it's active. The big question is, would you use chemotherapy or would you use this drug? I think generally or would you use ven-aza? I mean, there's very good data for ven-aza in salvage of NPM1 mutant disease, and we don't necessarily talk about that all that much, but it's highly active. In fact, Andrew's data on kind of MRD relapses rather than full-blown relapse are very impressive. That's a very good way to actually control that disease, get people to transplant, and get long-term survival. So I think it's very individualized. So that's an easy out for your question.
Okay.
Is to say, it really depends. Are you talking about an MRD relapse? Are you talking about a full-blown relapse? Are you talking about a FLT3 mutant patient?
So I'm going to make someone answer this question. So the patient has failed ven-aza. Mm-hmm. The patient has intensive chemotherapy, transplant, relapse post-transplant, NPM1 mutant, no FLT3 ITD. Post-transplant, they relapse 4 months post-transplant. Post-transplant, they get ven-aza. Ven-aza does not lead to a complete remission.
Yeah, I think that's a
now you're stuck patient. Without a clinical trial, and you are. I'm not sure what your options are. In that case, would you write a prescription off-label for revumenib?
I think that's the kind of patient that could benefit from a drug like revumenib.
Okay, that might
absolutely
benefit. Okay, yeah. Fair.
I mean,
okay.
We don't. We have a press release. We don't have a trial result. This will obviously be coming soon to a major meeting near you or a publication. But other than the Journal of Press Releases, we don't have a lot of data.
Totally fair. And then, Eunice, I wanted to get back to you. So there's been a lot of talk about differentiation syndrome on all of these trials.
Yes.
I guess my question is, do you think there's something, I'm not so interested in differences between drugs, but do you think just as a general category, the differentiation syndrome seen with drugs that target with menin inhibitors is qualitatively different than when you see differentiation syndrome with ATRA?
Yes.
Or you do?
I definitely think, and I think that there's a difference even between the differentiation syndrome that we're seeing with menin inhibitors in KMT2A rearranged patients versus NPM1 patients. The former seem to have a higher rate of differentiation syndrome, which could be across the classes of agents, than NPM1, which I think has to do with their biology. But what we see with the menin inhibitors is we see immediate differentiation syndrome. We've seen patients that get on study, and within a few days, and you'll see this data again at the AML session in the menin inhibitors, we see patients have their white counts shoot up. We've seen patients that have white counts go up to 50, 60, 80, 90 within 5 to 7 days of starting the menin inhibitor, and develop overt disease, so much so that many of the menin inhibitors now are incorporating prophylactic steroids and addition of cytotoxic agents when the white count with these agents go above 10 or 20%, or if there's any signs or suspicion. We also see profuse, I think, in when we think about ATRA-related differentiation, we see the blasts eventually turning into neutrophils quickly over time, which gives you confidence that you see differentiation. What we see with menin inhibitors is we see this shooting up of the white count, and we see profound blasts and monocytes. And that does not mean their disease has acutely accelerated. It is a side effect of the unique ability of these agents and their potency. And we also, with at least two of the inhibitors, have seen grade 5 differentiation effects. However, I don't think this is going to be a limiting toxicity. Just as we learned with ATRA and arsenic and IDH inhibitors, these can be fatal complications. But with mitigation strategies and recognition, they are clinically manageable.
Okay. I do have a question that came in from the web, for a Zoom question. I'm going to pitch this one to Andrew. Would you consider oral azacitidine, CC486, as a maintenance strategy post-transplant for patients who were NPM1 MRD positive, I think, going into the transplant?
So for patients who are MRD positive for NPM1 pre-transplant. The results are that outcomes post-transplant are quite good unless the patient has a concurrent FLT3 ITD. So if there's no FLT3 ITD, I wouldn't be using any maintenance therapy. For patients who are FLT3 positive, then obviously the Morpho study would inform us that post-transplant gilteritinib is the way to go. In terms of oral azacitidine in general, there's a randomized study, Amadeus, that we're waiting for the readout for broader patients beyond that. The role of menin inhibitors, we don't know.
Fair. I had another question that comes up about totally off the topics we talked about, but I wanted Rich to answer it. There's been a lot of excitement about CAR T cells in various diseases. There are now more and more trials with CAR T cells for acute myeloid leukemia. Where do you see that going? How do you see that evolving? What are your impressions of the studies so far?
My impression of the studies so far is highly disappointing, obviously. There haven't been, this is the occasional response, but nothing sustained. I'm particularly intrigued by a paper that was written by one of Dr. Pearl's colleagues, Dr. Gill, who's a senior author on a paper that suggested that CAR T cells in AML have an intrinsic problem that when the T cells get activated, they release cytokines, which my old boss, Jim Griffin, showed in 1990, were growth food for, tumor food for AML cells. Why we didn't think of this before, I don't know, but I give Sarah a tremendous amount of credit for this work. I know not everybody believes this, but I've seen plenty of patients who've gotten these AML CD123 CARs. They get sick as hell. The AML looks like it should go away, like it does in ALL, but it doesn't go away. So I think there's something to this, and maybe some very exotic strategies will be needed to take advantage of the power of CAR T cells and AML that we haven't quite done yet. So we'll see.
Sasha, do you have any comments on
that? No, I'm a co-author on that, but very far in the middle. Can't take a lot of credit for what Sarah and others observed.
Take credit
but,
for it.
But bottom line is I think, it's an intriguing idea as to why, one of the many reasons why we're just not seeing the same level of efficacy in AML as we're seeing in many of the lymphoid malignancies, in ALL and lymphoma, myeloma, et cetera.
And then a question for Sasha, maybe this is the last question. What do you do for maintenance guilt post-transplant when your patient has a FLT3 TKD? And I think that question gets to really, what are the results in the Morpho trial when you break it down by FLT3-ITD and FLT3-TKD?
I don't think we looked on Morpho at patients who had both mutations. It didn't keep you off the study if you had an ITD and you also had a TKD, but none of these patients went on study with active leukemia. They all had to be in remission at the time they went on the study. And I, to my knowledge, I don't think we went back to look to see how many had TKD at initial diagnosis. I think the TKD doesn't usually fall out as a driver of relapse to any degree like the ITD does. So if somebody only had a FLT3 TKD and they go to transplant for one reason or another, I mean, you can give maintenance, but I just don't know that you're going to see the same efficacy as what we see with a FLT3 ITD positive patient.
Okay, well, with that, I want to give all of my presenters a big round of applause. That was wonderful. Okay, thank you so much, guys.